The federal minimum wage has been set at $7.25 for more than a decade. And while the cost of living has gone up, that number has not.
All labor has dignity. Whether you work at McDonald's, you're a janitor, or you work at the White House, all labor has dignity and should be treated with such. And even when we look back at history, many folks don't know Dr. King was standing with sanitation workers.
Terrence Wise works at McDonald's in Kansas City, Missouri. As department manager, he earns $14 an hour, and he says it's still not enough to get by.
I know so many folks come to my job and they see me smile at McDonald's and I'm happy, but they don't know that I haven't seen a doctor in 18 years. I don't have dental insurance. I've never had a paid vacation or anything of that nature.
Raising the wage to $15 an hour is part of President Biden's COVID relief package. Senate Democrats took the first step last night to pass that bill. They did it along party lines. And while it's unclear whether the minimum wage provision will survive passage, several moderate Democrats are reluctant to raise the federal minimum wage that high. Workers like Terrence Wise are crossing their fingers. He's 41 and has worked in fast food for almost 20 years. He's also a leader in the Fight for 15 movement.
I live right in the Midwest, Kansas City. When you put in a living wage calculator here for my city, my zip code, a single family, you know, two parents, one child, a living wage here in Kansas City is $23 an hour.
Wise isn't even close to that number. And for many months, he hasn't been close to covering his bills. Not for the first time, Wise was recently served an eviction notice.
When the sheriff knocked on the door to evict my family, it wasn't me, it was my kids that answered the door.
Wise says he worries about money, but also the mental toll that poverty has taken on his family. Hannah Awad also knows what it's like not to make enough. She graduated from Oregon State University in 2016, and she took two jobs after graduating. One at Whole Foods, the other at sporting goods retailer REI.
I would like open Whole Foods and then I would close REI. So in the same day, I was working literally from 6 a.m. until like 10 p.m.
At both jobs, she made under $12 an hour. And even working overtime, it wasn't enough to cover her monthly expenses.
You can't afford to buy in bulk. If you're a dollar short on your credit card payment, they don't care. You still get charged a fee for being late. So it's like more expensive to be poor.
And like many recent graduates, she's dealing with that pressure to pay off her student debt.
I had a student loan. I'm still paying it off. I really just couldn't afford my student loan payments every month.
Now, as a graduate student living in Rhode Island, she receives a stipend of $160 a week. She also works as a part-time substitute teacher.
I'm subbing for a teacher who currently has COVID. There's no like air ventilation, like filters in my classroom. I have to remind teachers every day to put their mask over their nose.
Each day of substitute teaching brings Awad a day rate of $100. That's under $15 an hour. As people like Hannah Awad and Terrence Wise wait to see what Congress does now, we wanted to look back because for most of American history, there was no federal minimum wage at all. That's according to Alora Derenincourt. She's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley. Calls for a federal wage floor grew during the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt was reshaping the economy with his New Deal. And that's where we're going to start this history of the minimum wage, at one of FDR's fireside chats back in 1938.
Consequently, I am again expressing my hope that the Congress will enact at this session a wage and hour bill putting a floor under industrial wages and a limit on working hours.
The motivation for a lot of the legislation during the New Deal was to address massive unemployment and economic hardship.
To ensure a better distribution of our prosperity, a better distribution of available work, and a sounder distribution of buying power.
So when the minimum wage was first introduced as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, there was actually a protracted struggle between President Roosevelt and Southern congressmen who were staunchly opposed to the law.
What is the argument from Southern Democrats? How explicit are they when it comes to race? And what concessions are made to bring them on board?
Southern politicians who really raise the specter of having to pay a minimum wage to Black domestic workers in private households. And they were very much opposed to this and argued that the Southern context was different. It was a lower wage region and a minimum wage would destroy Southern industry. So ultimately, the law that came about was the result of a compromise between these forces.
So the Depression era ends with a compromise on the minimum wage, in large part to appease Southern Democrats and also to withstand court challenges over what industries the federal government had the power to regulate under the Constitution.
Key industries that were actually left out of coverage by the 1938 law were agriculture, retail, and services. And the latter are some of the canonical minimum wage industries of today.
But calls for expanding that minimum wage didn't go away. By the 60s, those calls were taken up by the civil rights movement and were a big theme of the March on Washington in 1963. Derenincourt says that aspect of the march is often forgotten.
You know, it was called the March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens. But those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them.
And a big focus of the key organizers of that march, A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, was actually the economic rights of Black Americans, which they also viewed as lagging behind.
We demand that there be an increase in the national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity.
So there were 10 demands of the March on Washington, and if I remember correctly, number 9 was for an expanded Fair Labor Standards Act that covered all employment, and number 8 was for a $2 national minimum wage at the time, which today translates to over $15 an hour when you adjust for inflation.
Okay, so when Congress amended the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1966, what was the result of that?
Lyndon Johnson, when he signed the 1966 Fair Labor Standards Act amendments into law, expanded coverage to agriculture, retail, services, hospitals, schools, all of these sectors that had been excluded from the original 1938 law.
We have included more than 9 million new workers under a higher minimum wage.
First of all, Black workers were overrepresented in the newly covered sectors. A result of the law was that the wages of workers in these newly covered sectors improved substantially, and the improvements were twice as large for Black workers as they were for white. The expansion of minimum wage coverage alone explains about a fifth of the reduction in racial inequality in the post-civil rights era.
The last time the federal minimum wage was raised was 2009. Can you give us a picture of who makes the federal minimum wage in the U.S. today?
As of 2019, about 2% of workers were paid the prevailing federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. The law that's being proposed today in terms of its impacts on workers and which workers has a lot of echoes with the expansion in minimum wage coverage in the 1960s. At that time, expansion in coverage affected about 20% of the workforce, 30% of Black workers, and actually the Raise the Wage Act of 2021 would also affect about 20% of U.S. workers and about 30% of Black workers.
The Raise the Wage Act gives up to 33 million Americans a long overdue raise.
There ain't nobody in America, not in the North, the South, the East, or the West, who can survive on $7.25 an hour.
It should be a national minimum wage of $15 an hour. No one working 40 hours a week should live below the poverty line.
The increase in the minimum wage would disproportionately benefit Black workers. We think that that could reduce racial inequality today, which is still at very high levels.
You mentioned that the minimum wage they were calling for at the March on Washington, that's equivalent of more than $15 an hour today. What does that say to you?
It tells me that it's an evergreen demand in some sense, but also that both policy and the institutions that represent workers or that increase the bargaining power of workers have been on the decline We know that unionization rates in the U.S. are at an all-time low. We know that the federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 for over a decade, which means that it's been declining in real terms because of inflation. We also know that if the minimum wage had tracked productivity gains since the 60s, it would be much, much higher today. Part of the demands of the March on Washington was for a $2 national minimum wage that's over $15 an hour today. And when the movement for a $15 minimum wage known as Fight for 15 was launched, that's exactly the time when a $2 minimum wage was equivalent to a $15 minimum wage. In other words, you know, in 2012, when there was a national movement to raise the wage to 15, that was exactly what the organizers of the March on Washington were calling for.
That's UC Berkeley professor Alora Derenincourt on the century-long fight over the federal minimum wage, a fight that is once again playing out on Capitol Hill.